Okay, I'd like to introduce the moderator, Stephanie Mehta. And Stephanie oversees technology, international, and Washington coverage for Fortune. And she also sets the overall editorial direction for the magazine and serves as co-chair on two of the Fortune's live events, Brainstorm Tech and the Most Powerful Women Summit.
Thank you very much. Can everybody hear okay? Terrific. We've got to make up a little bit of time this afternoon, so we're just going to jump right into it. As was noted in the previous session, it has been an extraordinary few months for empowered users of technology. The Arab Spring and the actions in Egypt in particular have demonstrated the power of social networking as a tool for political and social change. This weekend, the New York Times reported that the U.S. State Department and Defense Department have been working together to develop the Internet in the Suitcase, essentially a mesh network that enables users in countries where there has been a failure of the telecommunications networks to essentially do an end run. And there are all kinds of exciting things happening in the world of the Internet and technology when it comes to user empowerment. On the other hand, the day after the report on Internet in a Suitcase came out in the New York Times, the same newspaper reported on their front page that the FBI is weighing guidelines to expand the agent's use of their ability to search databases and use technology for surveillance. And we're watching investors reward technology companies that amass large numbers of subscribers, in part because those subscribers turn over incredible amounts of data that can be mined and monetized. So it is indeed an extraordinary time, and the future is only going to get more interesting. We're here today to discuss the role that users will play in shaping the internet and internet policy, but obviously the platform is so much bigger. Empowered technology users can bring down governments, and depending on your perspective, help enrich or impoverish would-be technology entrepreneurs. To help us understand the role that the user is, can, and will play in shaping the internet, we have this very esteemed group of panelists. You have all their bios in front of you, so I'll just run through them quickly. Eben Moglen is a professor at Columbia University and director, counsel, and chairman at the Software Freedom Law Center. David Gross is an former ambassador and partner at Wiley Rhine, and he's one of the foremost experts on telecommunications policy worldwide. Gigi Sohn is president and co-founder of Public Knowledge, which promotes democratic principles and cultural values around openness, access, and the ability to create and compete. And finally, Brad Burnham is a partner at Union Square Ventures here in New York. He's a former AT&T executive who helped create that company's venture capital arm, and he serves on the board of companies like Meetup, Bug Labs, Tumblr, and Pinch Media. And finally, we have all of you. This is, after all, a panel about empowered users, and so we intend to empower you and bring you into the conversation early. So please have your questions and thoughts percolating early in the conversation, and please feel free to raise your hand if you wish to weigh in. I'm going to start with you, Eben. People use the term user and consumer somewhat interchangeably. In our dialogue, you took a little bit of issue with that. What is the difference in your mind between a user and a consumer? And I guess the question is, how can users best use their power in 2011?
The people we're calling users built the net. They're not something unnecessary to it, and they're not the end point in it. Vint and I and everybody else who wrote code and created communities are users, and we built the net. The net we built had the properties that Vint said he wanted in a net in the future. It had anonymity, it had security, it had openness, it had transparency. We are now in the process of watching four kinds of forces trying to take the net away from us. Governments, which, as Vince says, are afraid of the reframing power of a dialogue democratically undertaken. Content owners, as they call themselves, who believe their bits are sacred, and who believe that the entire engineering of the net should be reshaped at any moment in order to protect the sacredness of their bits against the two things that networks are for: one, copying bits, and two, sharing bits. The data miners, who have a business model for industry in the 21st century, which is to figure out what you want before you know yourself and sell you to an advertiser quickly. And the network operators, whose job it is to break our networks and sell us the repairs. Those four forces put together are building a net which lacks anonymity, transparency, security, and the other things that Vince says he wants. And the reason is they don't work for us, they work for themselves. The important point about users is we use the net to do what we want. And the net, which is being technically redesigned beneath us, the one we made HTTP, we made Perl, we made Python, we made Linux, we made the stuff the net is made of. Don't be fooled into thinking somebody else made it and provided it to you. We made it. The net we made is being distorted. Power is being taken away from the edge and concentrated in the center. The net Vint was talking about has nodes which are peers. The very idea that there is such a thing as a servant and a client, or a master and a slave, or a consumer and a provider, is an cultural imposition on the technology of the net. What users are going to do next is they're going to take power back to the edge. In the same way that they have in media, in the same way that they have in software, we're going to do it with the net itself. By eliminating the idea that there are servers and then there are clients and that there are customers and then there are providers. This is a 21st century server. As powerful as the server that sits on a rack or under a desk or on it, using about a tenth as much power and providing all of the communications facilities that you would expect a service providing computer on the net to have, as well as a couple of radios for making mesh. Never mind the suitcase. They're the State Department. They pack heavy. Our net is going to be made of small, cheap devices which are going to contain free software whose purpose is to serve privacy, to serve transparency, to serve anonymity to us. Vint is correct about what we want, he's correct about what we need, and he and we are the people who know how to make it. We're going to have free telephony, that is, safe telephony, secure telephony, accessible telephony, inexpensive telephony, and network operators are going to have a little trouble. We're going to have anonymous publication and sharing, and content owners are not going to have sacred bits. We're going to throw down governments that hurt people, that tear out their fingernails, that destroy them. And we're going to make it difficult to data mine people because we're going to restore the anonymity, which is the absolute fundamental requirement of decent human life. The project I'm working on at the moment is called Freedom Box. It's not this. This is capitalism. It takes care of itself. It's just free software. It's just an SD card load to take things like this and make them serve you instead of someone else. We're going to carpet bomb the net with freedom. It's going to work. We're going to get what we want. The people who don't want us to get what we want can stuff it. Thank you very much.
Gigi, I'm going to turn to you. You were nodding quite a bit during Evan's comments, but you represent all consumers. You don't represent just users, just the people who built the net. There are everyday people out there who are benefiting from the work that Evan and his peers have done, but at the same time are not active participants in their internet use. So how do consumers empower themselves?
Right. I mean, you know, we not only deal with, you know, folks who follow Eben, and Eben is a visionary, of course, but we also deal with the ordinary consumer who, you know, wouldn't know that from a magic jack. And I have to deal with the day-to-day doings of Washington and the power of the network operators and the power of the copyright holders who are taking the internet we know today and closing it off. So I love what Evan has to say. I don't know when that's time is going to happen where we just, you know, carpet bomb them and have a whole new internet that's open and universally accessible and transparent and all the wonderful values that that Vint and Eben just talked about. But I'm dealing a lot with the here and now. And in the here and now, we're talking about a colossal merger of the first and fourth largest wireless providers, which are going to land up raising the price for wireless internet access, which is what most lower-income folks rely upon. I'm dealing with a bill called the Protect IP Act, which would allow the Attorney General to force internet service providers, search engines, domain name registers to block domain names. And you want to talk about fragmenting the internet, it would hurt DNSSEC, which Vint talked about. And you may have heard that the Department of Homeland Security, which has so much experience with copyright and the internet, is already taking down domain names, blocking domain names, some which are legal in the countries in which they exist. I'm talking about Roja Directa. So I love Eben's vision, but we are very, very far away from that right now. And right now, I've got to deal with the fact that the internet is nowhere near universally accessible and certainly nowhere near universally affordable. We have significant swaths of the population who cannot get on the internet because they live in rural areas or even underserved urban areas. It's too expensive for them. I've got to deal with an increasingly consolidating market. Essentially, most people have a choice of two landline internet providers, a cable operator and a telephone company in most communities, and we have a shrinking wireless market. And then, of course, we have Hollywood, which has unbelievable tentacles in the government. This is where I actually align with the network operators, and are essentially trying to break the internet to protect their copyright while the money keeps pouring in from international and national ticket sales and also from online streaming. Meanwhile, they won't even, I don't want to make a speech of this, but I'll just say one more thing. You know, meanwhile, they won't even try. They're barely trying to get their content out online when people want it at a fair price. So that's the here and now. And, you know, the geeks may use those systems, but to the extent that I'm concerned about, you know, sort of the broader, I don't think anybody's a consumer anymore because everybody uses the internet to create. Nobody just sits back and consumes like watching television. But to the extent that I'm representing more ordinary folks, I think right now they're getting royally screwed in Washington and we have a lot of concerns.
So how do we empower the masses? How do we get people who are affected by consolidation, by government policy, to be more proactive and to take a greater role in supporting what you're doing, Gigi?
Well, it's really difficult because, you know, at a certain level, people understand the kind of work my organization does. They understand that in order to have a democratic society where everybody can speak and be heard, you have to have decentralized, open, universally accessible communications systems. Everybody understands that, right? That's not that hard. But when you tell them what you actually have to do to get there, well, I've got to do this filing at the FCC and I've got to lobby Congress, then, you know, people's eyes start to glaze over. So I will admit, even though I've been doing this kind of work for 20 years, I haven't found the message that quite hits yet. So I'll take any advice anybody has, any advice from the audience on what the magic bullet will be to get people to understand how critical an open and democratic communication system is to their everyday lives, to getting jobs, you know, to being able to create, to being able to stay in touch with friends and family. I don't think people necessarily understand the connection of technology and policy.
Brad, you had something to add?
Well, I was just going to say that I think the root problem here is that the harm of a open internet is concentrated. It's concentrated with the copyright holders, it's concentrated with the network operators, because they lose control over their cost structures and they watch their cost structures collapsing as this network takes out their intermediary position. So it's very concentrated. It turns out that those people for whom the harm is very concentrated are very influential because they've spent years and years building relationships in order to influence policy to protect their interests. The benefits of an open internet are very diffuse. They accrue to startups, companies that for the first time ever can get directly to a consumer without asking permission. And they accrue to consumers who get the benefit of all of this innovation. Startups and consumers are not nearly as well organized in Washington as the incumbents are on both the intellectual property side and on the network side. And so if in trying to answer the question of what could one do, one could ideally figure out a way of using the internet to organize these diffuse interests into a more concentrated interest to represent a counterweight in Washington. Not quite sure how to do it, and I think ultimately you grapple with the problem that I think it was Oscar Wilde who said the problem with being a socialist is you have to go to lots of meetings. And I'm not sure that consumers yet understand how important it is to go to those meetings.
You know, I think it was June who asked the question about the Fifth Estate and other countries being very aware of it, but not so much in the United States. And David, I guess implicit in June's question was this idea that maybe we're a little apathetic in the United States, or maybe we don't quite realize the power of the tools and the technologies and the freedoms we're afforded. Can you respond and speak to that a little?
Well, that may well be, but I guess let me just go back for a moment. You know, if you're listening to this conversation, you would think we're on the precipice of a disaster. Maybe it's my age or something, but I grew up before the internet. And the changes that have occurred, the empowerment of individuals, the economic progress, the political change, the freedoms that have occurred in the United States and particularly around the world, which is where I focus most of my attention, are nothing short of historic and miraculous. Now, I'm not taking issue with any of the comments made because these are discussions, these are debates that are critical for ensuring that we continue to make progress. So I'm not here to say that all is well and that we should just stop where we are. Quite the opposite. But from my perspective, as someone who's been involved in policymaking and industry, and government service for a good number of years, is that what has driven this progress has been technology. It has not been policymakers. Sometimes they get in the way, sometimes they promote. You can have a very serious discourse by reasonable and serious people about what those parameters should look like. But don't mistake the fact that there is a debate, and a serious debate, and serious issues, for a lack of progress that has, if anything, has continued to accelerate, not decelerate. That is true in the United States. As I look at the world that my 26-year-old son lives in as compared to when I was 26, his opportunities, his ability to communicate, his ability to connect, his ability to continue to have what I think is an extraordinarily bright future because of the technological changes that have occurred. And that pales in comparison to the opportunities that are true globally. And the changes we have seen, obviously the Arab Spring is one manifestation of that. But even that manifestation, as dramatic and as important as it is and has been, pales in comparison to the changes that have happened globally over the last decade or so. The changes that people have been able to be brought out of dire poverty, the ability of people to have access to information, the ability of people to no longer be captured by their history, but to be connected to the rest of the world, is nothing short of revolutionary and historic.
Yeah, we are really proud of the net we build, and I don't want to say that it isn't doing all the wonderful things you say it is. It is doing them. On the other hand, we now have a single centralized database with 600 million people or so in it, with their entire lives being documented and informed on by their friends. That system now incorporates facial recognition, which is busily being trained by all those 600 million people to improve its ability to identify a human being in a single webcam shot from any direction, any time, in any lighting.
That means that any government with the power of subpoena or coercion or bribery or purchase can now acquire, starting with a photograph of a human being, everything about that person's social life, affiliates, associates, habits, mechanisms, locales, modus operandi within seconds. All of which results not from the positive power of social networking, but from the danger of privacy invading technology, implementing important features in a suboptimal way. We now have to find a way to move those 600 million people safely and easily out of this animated spying system within which they are living their entire social lives, without disrupting their circles of friends or without causing them any feature loss. That's a serious technical problem. It's not going to be dealt with by legislation. It's not going to be dealt with by government. Governments need Facebook now because no national security system wants to be without Facebook now. So we have to fix the problem. What David has said is correct. We have changed the future of the human race with our technology in 20 years. Now we have to change it again.
Evan, I wonder if you would, you have a view on the degree to which a lot of the value that those 600 prisoners inside of Facebook...
600 million prisoners,
get out of that experience comes as a result of the fact that they're willingly sharing that data and others become aware of their interests and are allowed to and are able to interact with them.
Almost all the value comes that way, but none of that value requires a central database that somebody else can go behind. We're going to replace centralized social networking with federated social networking, which is going to give everybody an opportunity to do everything they now do except to contribute to Mark's great big database. We're going to do everything we were doing before. We're just not going to have the KGB watching us. That's all.
Brad, what is the role of, as the capitalist on the table? as the financier on the table, what is the role of the corporation? I mean, I hear what Evan is talking about, and I hear the word federated, and I think I feel like it's almost it lacks the panache and sophistication and marketing smarts that, you know, for-profit entities bring to the table. I mean, is there a value that corporations bring by trying to market this stuff and make it? And make us want to buy it before we know we want to buy it.
Yes, I think there's a value. I find myself in the position as a venture capitalist. I guess that's different than being a capitalist because I back small startup companies that are almost always the attackers, not the defenders. And so right now we have a lot of companies who are in some ways threatened by the scale of Google and Facebook, and you know, so we obviously would love to see an environment in which new ideas can compete very effectively with very established companies, even recently established companies like Google and Facebook. So I love the image of a flatter, decentralized, organic, emergent innovation that isn't controlled by a single entity, and I think we should all aspire to that, and I think that's actually good for capitalism, because I think it's more resilient, and I think it's more innovative. There are examples of situations where there's a trade-off between user experience and openness. And I think, Apple is one example of that, where Apple's decided they want to have a great deal of control over user experience, and therefore they've limited the degree to which people can innovate on top of that, on top of their tools and their platform. And I think they've demonstrated that, and you can look around the room, you see a lot of Macs on tables, they've demonstrated that there is a value in that. The question is, at what point does that value become a liability? And I think that historically it's been true that openness trumps integration during periods of rapid technical change, and during periods when that change is slowing, then the reverse happens, in integration trumps openness. And I think that's kind of a natural rhythm that'll keep going. But there's a role, for both. I'd like to think that the role is ideally architected such that companies are allowed, are not allowed, companies are enabled by the underlying market architecture to scale quickly and rapidly and bring new things to market quickly and rapidly, but then there's a natural fervor there or ferment there as new companies arise.
Gigi? I just want to add, I mean, to me, all layers of the internet are not created equal. And I'm much, much more concerned about the bottlenecks at the infrastructure layer. I saw an interesting fact yesterday that Facebook just lost 6 million users in 1 month. And I think we forget how young Google is, how young Facebook is, and I think things are really cyclical. I mean, does anybody remember Netscape anymore? Alta Vista? What was that, 15 years ago? They were the next big applications that were just gonna, you know, eat everybody up over the internet. So, you know, I am concerned about the growing power of Facebook and Google. I do wonder why you have, you know, one very dominant search engine, one very dominant social network, one very dominant online retailer, Amazon. I think antitrust officials are looking at that as well. I'm not sure what the policy answer is to that. But I think we do have to keep in mind history. AT&T has been around for 100 years. Okay, and they got broken up and they're getting put back together again. That's not as true with the applications layer. You see dominant applications come and go. So I guess I'm willing to give Facebook and Google a little bit more time before we engage in heavy-handed regulation. I'm not saying that I'm completely and totally opposed to some sort of consumer protection, fraud, or, you know, transparency regulation. Again, allowing people to control their own privacy and anonymity experience online. But I worry less about that than I do about the infrastructure.
I want to open it up to questions in just a moment and start getting your perspective and feedback. But David, coming back to this issue of the internet as a global entity, you know, our conversations have largely focused on U.S. policy. Tell us a little bit about what you're seeing around the world and how we make sure that globally the internet continues to function and is open and has full access and gets distributed to you know, as many users as possible.
Well, I guess in a nutshell, it's the usual. There's good news and there's bad news on these things, or troubling news perhaps. Good news is that people want it. People want more of it. Whether they're consumers or users, people who are involved, and the explosive growth that Vin talked about. I mean, it's quite extraordinary. 2 billion users today around the world and growing rapidly. Just extraordinary numbers, and those, as Vin pointed out, that are being connected through wireless is really where the engine of growth for internet access globally is at. And what you see going on from a policymaking perspective is very, very positive, generally speaking. But obviously there are a lot of issues, a lot of warning signs out there. A lot of governments are not happy about this. Those governments are not located just in a couple of regions. They are still quite global. The policy issues that they would like to see that could have an adverse impact on the sorts of issues you've been talking about today take many forms. For example, there are some governments, obviously, who are extraordinarily repressive and want to keep their people from having access to the internet itself. Cuba comes to mind, for example. There are people in jail today because of trying to bring internet access to the people of Cuba. There are others who have embraced the internet in certain ways, like China, which has the largest online population, but control access in many political and other economic ways quite substantially. You have other conversations in places like Europe, which on the one hand want to see more internet access, more high-speed broadband access and so forth, have policies designed to try to promote that, but are very concerned over what they consider the over-the-top side, which is basically the application side, which they view as primarily American and where the value seems to be going. So their view is, what's wrong with this picture? Why are American companies getting the value of the internet and so forth and not as much for the Europeans? So they have looking at policies that create issues there as well. So if you dig down, there's lots of things to be concerned about. Nevertheless, we're in an extraordinarily good time, generally. You compare where we are today to during the five, six, 8 years ago when there was a lot of concern about governments trying to take control of things like ICANN and others. There's still some of that rumbling going on, but it's certainly substantially less now than it was before.
Do we have any questions or comments from the audience? Is there a mic runner? There's a gentleman right up here in the Honolulu t-shirt.
The name is Eric, and I guess that the question focuses mainly to Mr. Moglen. If we're going to try to come out with a new topology for distribution of content to be more peer-to-peer based, where we don't have to go through a corporate entity, do you see that the main challenges are not on the software, but more on the physics that are involved with regards to actual distance that exists? And then even if someone comes up with a solution to that, like a more powerful transmitter, and the FCC gets involved.
No, Vint is right. The point about the network we built is that it doesn't care how you carry things. 9/10 of the time, we don't care about which of the people are moving our packets, and the 1/10 of the time when we do care, we can encrypt it, tunnel it, or otherwise do something about it that makes it harder to steal or observe or interfere with. The future of mesh networking and the future of Wi-Fi and the future of the other forms of self-assembled wireless net is very bright. The network operators spent 10 years scaring you out of running an open wireless router in your house. If everybody had been running open wireless routers in his house the past 10 years, VoIP would be giving Americans free phone calls everywhere, and people would have the kind of seamless, always-on mobile internet that they want, and they would be getting a tax cut of the roughly $100 a month they're currently paying to have a crappy version that works poorly. We got scared into not self-assembling a better net than we are presently provided by the people whose job is breaking it and making us pay them to fix it. What's going to happen is wireless routers are going to break around the world, and they're going to be replaced by things which are much more powerful and don't cost any more. And slowly, a better net is going to self-assemble around people, what you might want to call the cloud. A lot of servers running a lot of software that do a lot of stuff for human beings. And because the hardware is cheap and the software is free, the profit motive of the providers doesn't force the net to work a way you don't want it to work. Brad's correct. What we need now is user experience that makes it fun and easy to have a network that provides personal privacy to you. That's what the Freedom Box Project is for. Take all the functional software, Tor and GPG and Tink and OpenVPN and all the other wonderful stuff we've done in the last 20 years, and put it together in a package which gives ordinary human beings a thing cheap to buy and very easy to run that gives them functional privacy and allows them to communicate anonymously and freely. How long is it going to take, Gigi? About 2 years. The hardware is going to be ubiquitous in about 5, and we're going to be ahead of it. And a lot of it consists of network-equipped set-top boxes that are already being made in China and Vietnam for sale in their own home markets. Get used to it, kids. The Freedom Machines are coming. All we need to do is to provide the software. We make software. We made the software that makes the net. We know how. We're going to do it. It's going to happen. Public policy will be largely irrelevant. Times when rapid change makes public policy irrelevant are times which are called revolutions. There's one going on. It's going to destroy copyright law this generation. It's going to make it possible for every brain on earth to learn this generation. I said 15 years ago that if the thing we were calling the information superhighway had been called the universal education system, we would have different policy around it. I was right. It's the universal education system. Not for you and me, but for the kids in the street in Bangalore I work with. They know perfectly well that the internet is the universal education system, and they know that it would change their lives if they could learn anything they want. I work with a set of kids in a free software computing center in a slum in Bangalore where 2,200 people live with one toilet. 2,200 people, 1,478 children, one toilet, and 842 mobile phones, because mobile phones are available to the poorest of the poor. Now, we can put every book ever written, every painting ever painted, every piece of music, every scientific experiment, every map, every piece of knowledge which helps a human being to become himself or herself in the biggest way. We can put every one of those things on every one of those phones, but for the rules against sharing. How many of the Einsteins who ever lived were allowed to learn physics? How many of the Shakespeares who ever lived and died without learning to read and write? Pretty much all of them. We've always thrown away almost all the brains. In this generation, for the first time in the history of human beings, we don't have to. There are 6 billion people on Earth. 3 billion of them are under 25. How many Einsteins do you want to throw away today? So we're going to change the way the net works because we're going to try and educate every brain on Earth. You think there's an impacted, concentrated power that doesn't like free network? Think about the impacted, concentrated power that loves ignorance. Think of how ignorance has always been good for concentrated power throughout the history of the human race. Now imagine us fixing it. That's where we're going. The rest of this stuff is small beer.
A gentleman with the glasses in right there.
I'm Dennis Gilhooly from the United Nations, but I was a member, I think it was the Fourth Estate. As a journalist covering this from the early 80s and fighting with David on many, many panels over the years, you have to understand that what we're talking about, public policy is not going to go away, sir. What we're looking at, though, is a total radical rethink of the regulatory system across the board. Now, the FCC's approach to trying to push demand stimulus rather than supply stimulus was the first step at this. But there are certain things which we're going to have to do in terms of opening up military spectrum, where in most countries is owned 75% of the spectrum is owned either by the military or the government itself. There has to be a radical rethink, and we tried to do this with the Broadband Commission last year, which Vint was a major member and one of the sort of sub-authors, if you know what I mean. But this really does come back to public policy in the countries in terms of stimulating health and education and opening up the networks and public services. Thank you. I don't know whether anyone wants to comment on that.
Yeah, I was just afraid that I was going to have to shut down public knowledge in 2 years. But do you know that there are laws being passed as we speak today that make using an open Wi-Fi router illegal? Okay, so if you don't think that the incumbents are going to try to go into the states, to the FCC, to the Congress, to try to make your Freedom Box illegal, you're smoking crack, okay? And for that reason alone, public policy is not going to be irrelevant because there are companies, multi-billion dollar, multinational companies, and for every workaround, you know, they are going to try to get a law passed that makes that workaround illegal. So it's never going to go away. It may be, you know, we may be playing more of a defensive game, a la what we're doing in copyright now, and saying don't overregulate, as opposed to what we've been doing with net neutrality and saying let's have some pro-competitive regulation to tamp down the power of the incumbents. Maybe it's more of a defensive game, but the game's going to, as long as governments, unless you're also purporting to carpet bomb all governments, public policy, and all lobbyists, I'm not a lobbyist, public policy is always going to have a role. Spectrum, obviously, is very, very important. And I think there always will be a role for pro-competitive policies that promote innovation and openness. So,
let's see. Over here in the painter's cap, red shirt.
I've got a couple of questions. Oh, my name is Edward Hall, and so started a company here in New York City. It's an open source company, not necessarily applied to technology, but to approaches, and along the same lines as what our gentleman Mogulin was talking about. And I have a question about decentralized currency, as well as the idea of people self-electing themselves to be public servants on the web. So there's, I feel that these are two very important powerhouses that we have, I guess, as everyday people beyond the advent of technology, but actually having, there's a good actual example of this called Bitcoin. That's a completely decentralized anonymous currency that's actually quite contentious because it's being used in all kinds of underground markets. And so I'm interested in what your thoughts are on these, on the new advent of completely decentralized coinage, as well as people, you know, who are developing these technologies as like public servants, and the idea of that as like being a public servant to this web, this whole world web.
Well, I'd argue that the people who are creating Bitcoin do think of themselves as creating a service to the public. Creating a new kind of economy that may not be subject to all of the same constraints that a regulated economy is. I think we're, if I hear the conversation on the panel here, it's between Evan, who is convinced that we don't have to worry about what public policy is because we have a combination of technology and currencies and everything else that allow us to operate outside of that policy, and then Gigi, who's grappling with the way policy is constructed today. I think the reality is that there, it probably isn't a perfect world. I remember I grew up as this rabid libertarian, and I remember in college having these long debates late at night and, about why we needed government at all. And my roommate would always point out Beirut. And at the time, Beirut was just a complete shambles, and it was impossible to do anything. So there is some role for government in creating a framework. I think and it might actually exist in creating a framework around monetary policy, and it may be that an exchange rate between bitcoins and other currencies might have to have some kind of management in it. I don't know. I don't know what it would be. But it's the thing that I think we're not really discussing here, and I think, in fact, we've actually dodged it all the way through the afternoon here, as Bent was talking about the internet that he wants to see. He describes a set of things that are inherently contradictory. He wants privacy, and yet he wants safety. And we're going to have to figure out a way to bring those two together. Even if Evan's right, and in some ways I kind of hope he is, because it's a wonderful Wild West free market that he's describing that will create lots of innovation and opportunity, there is a transition period. There is there's a framework within which we all exist, and unfortunately, there are still people out there with guns who can enforce laws. And we're going to have to figure out how these two worlds fit together. I would like to see us try and grapple with these hard questions, and just instead of just saying we need a balance between safety and anonymity, let's talk about what principles we need to define where that balance should be, and who should administer that balance, and what the role between the relationship between the network and the host governments of that network should be.
Yeah, I think that's right. I don't think there's actually a disagreement. I think there's a difference of timescales. Gigi emphasized from the beginning that the point of view of a person working on the ground as a public policy lawyer is now. I teach in a law school. I make public policy lawyers. She's right. Now you have to worry about now. And in the world we live in now, you're always fighting the corruption of the other side. The FCC's real purpose is to get jobs for its former commissioners as highly paid lobbyists with network operators. All other activity is ancillary to the real purpose, right?
I love Evan. He makes me sound so moderate.
And that's what Larry Lessig means by I have to stop working on this stuff to work on political corruption, and I wait for the book with a good deal of expectation. This fall, we'll see what he means to say about political corruption in that regard. I think it's important. We are constantly, as Gigi says, enforcing an attempt to defend what we think our values are against concentrated people with too much money and too little public respect. Okay, fine. Now, I say, over the long scale, it's not about one guy fighting the good fight in Washington and another guy fighting the good fight in Brussels and another guy fighting the good fight in Moscow, each of them constantly trying to push uphill the immense torrent of money that wants to get married to power. Instead, we have to scale down and go low and do what we have done before to fight impacted power. You all really remember when Microsoft was the richest and most invulnerable country in the world and I was running the ragtag army of people who were one day going to be able to compete with it? You got to remember that what I'm talking about is not a vision. Don't buy that. I'm talking about what we've already done and what we're going to do next. I'm announcing to you what the program is. I will be wrong if you decide not to make it happen. But it is eminently possible, and it is surely going to occur if you want it. So Vince started in the right place. What do you want?
Evan, can I throw out a question and just say, is there any role at all in the vision that you're describing for some kind of collective governance and some kind of
platform, and let's just take the safety issue, is it for some way of assuring, or the internet fire department issue, is there some way that you could imagine that happening?
Sure. You don't notice any self-government in the Wikipedia or the Linux kernel? You don't notice us worrying about safety and flexibility and accessibility? The Apache Software Foundation doesn't care about security, safety, accessibility? We do self-government all the time. We do it every day. We do it the hard way. We are socialists, and we do go places in the evenings. Right? That's not the problem. It's not that we can't have government. It's that we don't want corrupt government. It's that we don't want government that worships the profit motive above technological elegance or human usability. It's that we now have to engage in an ecological activity of getting back from runaways the stuff they're making out of what we made. You point to all those Apple laptops in the room without saying they're made on our base. We make that stuff too. Steve comes along and puts razzle dazzle, sizzle on the steak, offers total contempt for the customers, and they pay too much to buy it. But the stuff in there is our stuff. We gave it to him. We said, here, this is a kernel. This is an operating system. You might like it. Want to use it? It's free. He said yes. I'm not surprised. Lots of people say yes to us because we're doing non-corrupt governance. We're making stuff work, and we're consultatively managing to make it happen. You think the Wikipedia is not an example of democracy? The problem is that 1% of the population owns nearly 48% of the wealth in the United States, and that produces concentrated power that wants its own lunch protected. We work for people. The network works for people. We don't want the lunch eaters to get it. So is there a room for democratic self-government in the net? You bet. Is that international? Yes. I have clients in every corner of the world. Do they govern their projects? Yes. Do they do so consultatively by sophisticated conversation and taking votes and doing what needs done by ruling by consensus? We're not backward politically. I'm not talking about some nonsense that we saw once in a utopian documentary about something we could do someday. I'm talking about where $100 billion worth of capital equipment came from that changed human civilization. We did it. Now we're going to do more. If you want it to support freedom, it will. If you get lazy and want it to support profit, it will do that too. And in the process, it will extirpate a lot of what we think makes human life worth living.
David, you wanted to respond.
I'll throw out another question. I'm having fun here. There is, let's talk about profit for a second. Is there any situation that you can imagine in which a market exists where players within that market are motivated by trying to serve consumers as well as they can in order to make money?
Absolutely. Every day, all day long. My clients work everywhere. IBM supports what I do. Hewlett-Packard supports what I do. Oracle supports what I do. We're not talking about a situation which requires us not to be in favor of capitalism. We're talking about a situation which requires us to understand that there are two pillars of the 21st century economy. One is owning, the other is sharing. The sharing economy is currently driving most of the social development on Earth. That's just a fact. That's okay. Capitalism is really good at doing what it does, which is to come along and market it and get it in every hand and make it accessible to everybody who can afford to pay, which is a tiny fraction of the people on the Earth. And it has real purposes. I'm not down on IBM's role in the free software revolution. IBM's role was crucial, is crucial, will be crucial. People who want to make money do lots of good things, but at the end of the day, they shouldn't define what kind of internet you want. That's all.
I agree. Only have a few more minutes, so I'm going to let David Gross take us out on a very upbeat note, since you're the, if Brad is the financier and Evan is a socialist, you're the optimist. So
that's always a good place to be, let me tell you. That's,
take us out.
How you got the deal.
Well, before I do that, I think one of the things Evan talks about, I think it's important, a lot of what he talks about is important, but the piece, to put it all together, is there is clearly an important role for government. government at its best is a reflection of what people's wills are. Obviously, there's often a great shortfall in many governments. But we have, and I think you'll be speaking soon, is Larry Strickling, who's been doing an extraordinarily good job on behalf of all of us in trying to grapple with the very tough issues you've been talking about. Things like allocation of spectrum, for which there was a question, trying to make sure that it's more effective. The issue of internet governance and the issue of things like the role, the relationship between governments, individuals, technology, and the like. And so I think it's extraordinarily important that one of the things that comes out of this discussion is not the fact that government is corrupt, but quite the opposite, that we're actually very fortunate in the United States. We have an extraordinary number of very, very good public servants who do it not for the money, but rather because they have a strong interest in making sure that we all have the opportunities that all of us, I think, are trying to ensure. That is, that technology leads, people are benefited, and that our children have the better day, not only in the United States, but globally, that comes from this extraordinary revolution that Evan talks about, through a variety of ways, no one size fits all, but rather that we continue to struggle with these issues, struggle with the public policy issues, so that in fact, as technology changes, as the world changes, as we change, that in fact we get to where we want to go, which is a better, more prosperous, more intelligent, more educated future for everyone.
On that note, I'd like to thank Internet Society for having us and our panelists, Evan Moglen, David Gross, Gigi Sohn, and Brad Burnham. A round of applause for the panel.